Good afternoon. Thank you for joining our call today, CMS Office Hours on COVID-19. This is Alina Chekai in the Office of the Administrator at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Today's call is the first in a series of opportunities for hospitals, health systems, and providers to ask questions of agency officials regarding CMS's temporary actions that empower local hospitals and healthcare systems to increase hospital capacity, rapidly expand the healthcare workforce, put patients over paperwork, and further promote telehealth and Medicare. I'm joined today by a number of subject matter experts from CMS who are here to answer your questions. I'd like to note that this call is open to everyone, and today's call is being recorded. If you are a member of the press, you may listen, but please send your questions directly to the CMS Office of Media Affairs at press@cms.hhs.gov. With that, we will open up the lines and take our first question. Operator, please open the lines.
As a reminder, to ask a question, you will need to press star 1 on your telephone. To withdraw your question, press the pound key. Please stand by while we compile the Q&A roster. Your first question is from a line. Please state your name and then ask your question. Your line is now open.
Hello?
Hi, what is your question?
Hi. My name is Leslie Naramore, and I am with the American Gastroenterological Association. Can you guys hear me?
We can. Thank you.
Excellent. Sorry. So I was wondering if I could get clarification on a letter to clinicians that the CMS Office of Communication sent out today. Is that an appropriate forum for this, or is this an appropriate forum for that? Sorry.
Sure. Happy to take your question.
Excellent. So the letter appears to present new rules for reporting audio-only E&M, but the letter is kind of presented as an overview of what the agency has already done. So maybe that's what's kind of throwing me off a little bit. So I don't know if you have it available, but I was just wondering if it's correct to interpret CMS's language on Medicare telehealth visits on page 3 of that letter in the please note paragraph to be new rules that allow providers to report E&M codes 99201 through 99215 for audio-only telephone calls when two-way audio and video technology isn't available, but when the service can still be provided using audio-only communication. Is that accurate?
Ryan, you want to take that?
Sure. So, Liz, do you want to take it? So I can answer it. Under the current rules, the codes that should be used for audio only evaluation and management would be the telephone evaluation and management codes, which are not the 99201 through 15 codes, but are specific CPT codes for telephone or audio only evaluation and management.
Okay, that's what I thought, but I would call your attention to the please note that was stuck in there because it says, in a case where two-way audio and video technology required to furnish a Medicare telehealth visit might not be available, there are circumstances where prolonged audio-only communication between the practitioner and the patient could be clinically appropriate, yet not fully replace a face-to-face visit, and that may cause some confusion and make some providers think that if they're unable to establish that two-way audiovisual communication with the patient, either because the patient declines it or because they tried for 30 minutes and just couldn't get the platform working, that they might be able to use the 99201 through 99215 as telehealth. And certainly that is something that the provider community, has been asking CMS to do. So I guess thank you for giving me this opportunity for that clarification.
Thank you. We'll take our next question, please.
Your next question is from a line. Please state your name and then ask your question. Your line is now open.
Hello?
Hi there. We can hear you.
Oh, okay. I'm calling from the California Hospice Association, and our question is regarding Medicare telehealth and the waiver that was approved for flexibility, which is that we can provide telehealth under the routine home care or a face-to-face encounter with a nurse practitioner or an MD or a DO. And I want to confirm that it can be a voice-to-voice mechanism for telehealth. We do not have, and most of our patients and families' homes do not have the capacity to do any video. They mostly use landlines. So can you confirm for me that hospice providers can use voice-to-voice in the routine home care telehealth as well as the face-to-face encounter?
Hey there, this is Hillary Leffler. I can jump in. You can use a landline for routine home care visits in lieu of an in-person visit. For the face-to-face requirement, right now we're requiring the two-way audio-visual communication. But I can definitely take your concerns down and see if there's any potential for revisiting that in the future.
Okay, so can you can confirm that we can use voice-to-voice?
You can use voice-to-voice for RHC, but not for
okay.
the face-to-face encounter requirement.
Okay. Thank you so much for the clarification, and we look forward to getting some flexibility around the face-to-face encounter.
No problem.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take our next question, please.
Your next question. Please state your name and then ask your question. Your line is now open. To the participants, press the star one. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Jonathan Gold from AMRPA. Can you hear me?
We can. Thanks for joining.
Great. Thank you. My question pertains to the hospital without walls and as well as a few other hospital-specific waivers you've issued. And for those instances where you just state it applies to hospitals, does that apply to a rehabilitation hospital or, as CMS refers to them, an inpatient rehabilitation facility?
So this is Jason Bennett. Let me try to address that. I think with regard to, are you specifically thinking about a freestanding IRF, or are you talking about units, excluded part units within a hospital?
Sure. For example, if a freestanding IRF needed to treat a patient at an external location, or if they also if a IRF unit needed to treat a rehabilitation patient at a location outside of either the unit or outside of the hospital itself.
Okay, so I think what you're describing is a scenario where the IRF is actually expanding beds beyond what its normal footprint would be, and considering those to be patients for purposes of IRF payment. Is that right?
That could be right. Or if, say, let's say if there's an IRF unit and within an acute care hospital, so it's a distinct part unit, and the hospital, the acute care hospital has to begin using that rehab unit, could then the hospital start treating those distinct part units patients at a location outside of the four walls of their hospital with using the hospital without walls waiver?
Okay. I think I understand the scenario that you're talking about. I'll need to confer with our colleagues and get back to you in more detail. But what you definitely can do with an excluded distinct part unit is that you can move patients between the IPPS portion to the IRF and vice versa, and then pay and then bill according to the type of patient that they are. So if the IRF move, if the patient in an IRF excluded part unit moves into an IPPS bed, then it's appropriate to still bill that patient as an IRF patient under the blanket waiver. But we'll get back to you as to whether or not that patient could be moved to, say, an IPPS bed that's been set up in a more remote location or new sort of facility that's been built to help address the larger surge capacity.
Thank you. We would really appreciate that clarification.
Next question, please.
Your next question, please state your name and then ask your question. Your line is now open.
Hello, can you hear me?
We can, thank you.
Thank you. My question is related to hospice visits in routine home care for services provided in the last 7 days of life. I understand that for telehealth nursing visits, they can satisfy visit requirements but shouldn't be reported on the claim. How are hospices are hospices able to report in some way the SIA adjustment visits through telehealth? Is that something CMS can consider as it stands right now without being able to report telehealth visits on the claim? Don't believe there's any way for a hospice to receive an SIA adjustment.
Sure. Hi, this is Hillary Leffler. We can definitely take that back for consideration. As you know, the SIA is paid for visits in the last 7 days of life. And so the current thinking is telehealth would be part of the routine home care rate and would not rise the level of requiring us to pay an add-on payment for that, but that's something that we can, take back and think about further.
Wonderful. And then a follow-up question. There are some facilities that are just blanketly not allowing hospice providers to get in their walls and care for patients. I understand the quote-unquote hysteria. However, for those patients, can you talk to and or consider initial nursing assessments via telehealth, and whether or not you would allow any expansion of the telephone only for face to face in those instances. I know someone just asked about telephone only, but there's an issue with being able to even access patients.
Sure, and we can consider, thinking about the face-to-face requirements further. Is there anybody from CCSQ on that wants to jump in about the initial assessment?
This is David Wright. I believe that we've allowed this to be done via telehealth as well. Was that the question?
Okay, just double checking. So the initial assessment for hospice admission can be done through telehealth.
Right. I don't believe that we have a requirement that it has to be face to face, and so we're including that within the telehealth rubric as well.
Wonderful.
Hi, David. This is Danielle. I would just want to add on to that it is correct that hospices may use telehealth to do this to the extent that the use of telehealth is actually capable of providing a full assessment of a patient and caregiver's needs. And that's really what it comes down to as far as compliance with the COPs is concerned, is were you able to fully assess the patient's needs in a way that allows you to develop an accurate care plan and deliver services?
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Next question. Please state your name and then ask your question. Your line is now open.
Hello. Hi there, we can hear you.
Great. This is Sarah Warren with the American Speech Language Hearing Association. I just want to thank you guys for all of your hard work over the last several weeks. And I know that your job is not anywhere near complete. You've got a lot to do. And so I just want to give kudos to you all for that. And I appreciate it. And I appreciate what you guys have done so far for non-physician practitioners like audiologists and speech language pathologists who under statute typically aren't allowed to provide or get coverage for services provided via telehealth. In the interim final rule that was issued last Monday, so the 30th, you allowed for the billing of certain speech language pathology CPT codes, for example, 92507, but you made it clear in the rule that those services weren't allowed to be billed by speech language pathologists, that they had to be billed by a physician. The fact sheet that accompanied that rule referred to speech language pathology services, and it's created a great deal of confusion in the provider community about whether speech language pathologists are allowed to bill for those codes via telehealth at this time. And I know that you guys, after that rule was pretty much written and ready to go, you guys got some additional waiver authority that you're looking at in terms of expanding telehealth possibly to additional categories of providers like audiologists and SLPs. But I was just hoping that you could just clarify that yes, certain CPT codes that might be billed by SLPs are allowed to be billed via telehealth, but only by physicians based on the provisions of the interim final rule, to help try to clarify that confusion. Obviously, we're disappointed by that, but we recognize your statutory limitations at the time the rule was written. But I just feel like it'd be very beneficial to have that clarity.
Sure. You're absolutely right. To make that clear, that your interpretation of the way the rules work now is accurate, and as you also noted very well, that there are new authorities under the CARES Act, and we're really actively working on those. And we certainly appreciate the reason for the confusion, and we're anticipating being able to make clear some of that in the near future as we continue to take a look at what authorities we have.
Thank you, and I appreciate that you're working on the new stuff that you got through the CARES Act, and we're really looking forward to that. And if there's anything we can do to be helpful, please do not hesitate to reach out to us. But I know we've been talking a little bit, and I know there's limitations on what you can say, so I appreciate that. But I just want to say thanks again for all of your hard work.
Thank you very much.
Next question, please state your name and state your question. Your line is now open.
Hello.
Hi there, we can hear you.
Hello.
Hi there, what is your question, please?
Can you hear? Hi there. I represent a large hospitalist group, and we were looking for some clarification when our hospitalists are in the same facility as the patient and they provide a virtual service to the patient, specifically using, you know, an iPad or other what's traditionally considered telehealth equipment. So they'd be using an iPad and Skype or Apple FaceTime, and they're removed from the patient. So not in front of the patient, removed from the patient in another part of the hospital. And they provide an E&M service, an initial or subsequent or discharge service to that patient via virtual service, but in the same facility. Is that payable as a regular E&M service? Does that take the place of your typical in-person face-to-face visit?
Ryan, I think you've answered that one before.
Yeah, happy to answer it again. So, I think under our current rules, the telehealth services only applies to when the patient and the practitioner are in different locations.
So in the circumstance when they're both in the institutional setting of a hospital, even if they're in different rooms or on different floors, for example, the service is fully described by the codes that are reported, then telehealth rules wouldn't be applicable. In other words, to the extent that the services that are reported and described by the codes can be done using communication technology or otherwise, the telehealth rules don't apply. And so I think in the description, so far as I understand it, that you've given, the codes could be billed without the telehealth modifier.
Okay, and that was my question exactly. Can they be still billed even though we're using virtual, not in-person, face-to-face? They can still be billed. We just don't use that modifier 95 because it doesn't meet the criteria for telehealth. I just want to make sure we're okay to submit those regular E&M codes.
Yep.
Right, and I would point out that where the code descriptor says face-to-face, it's that sort of gets at where, say, for example, a video component would be really important in the delivery of the service.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay, thank you so much. That has just helped probably thousands of hospitalists who are out practicing in their hospitals to try to minimize exposure and PPE use. So thank you for clarifying that for us.
And we're looking at whether we could provide that in a more formal way as well.
That would be fantastic.
Thank you for your question. We'll take our next question, please.
Your next question, please state your name and then ask your question. Your line is now open.
Hi there. What is your question?
Operator, can we take our next question, please?
Yes, ma'am. One moment, please.
Just give it a chat about this.
I'm sorry about that. Your next caller, please state your name and then ask your question. Your line is now open.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi there. We can hear you.
Hi. I'm calling to a question about the telephone CPT codes 99441 through 99443. Since many of the elderly patients with Medicare don't have access to video, will Medicare be recognizing those CPT codes?
So, sure. So under the new interim final rule, they're payable CPT codes for telephone evaluation and management services that are payable under the physician fee schedule, much like the standard E&M visits are. But they have specific CPT code numbers.
Okay, and where can those be found?
Those are on the same place. They're both in the CPT book as well as anywhere where there's a listing of a Medicare physician fee schedule code. So on the websites for the Medicare Administrative Contractors as well as on CMS's website for the physician fee schedule files.
Not the G2012 code, right?
No, that is the virtual check-in code, which is also separately payable. But the CPT codes are 99441 through 99443, and they describe telephone evaluation and management services.
Okay, so in the new bulletin or new act, you guys are going to be setting a reimbursement rate for those CPT codes because currently there isn't one.
Those codes should have a payable a payment amount, and depending upon where you're looking, it may take some time before the payment files are updated. But they are payable services as of the date of the PHE.
Okay, if I could ask one more question in the same relation, if a provider is doing an audio-visual service, and in the midst of the in the audiovisual service, the patient has an issue with the video either freezing or it being dropped. Is the telehealth service still billable as the E&M with the 95 modifier?
So I think if enough of the service was furnished with the audio and video capable, that the code continues to describe the service that was furnished, then generally that code would be appropriately reported. If the service that was ultimately reported is better described by the telephone evaluation and management, because that's where the bulk of the service was, then the telephone evaluation and management would generally be reported. And I say that as a general note for coding policy, not specific. I think in an individual case, you'd want to, there'd probably be a lot to take a look at. But I think merely the presence of some sort of interruption wouldn't necessarily mean that telehealth, that the audio and video code wouldn't be appropriate. Likewise, any use of video alone when it wasn't sort of a central part of the service probably wouldn't be appropriately reported either.
Okay. Can I ask one more question, or am I timed out?
We'll allow one more question for the greater good. I know there's a lot of questions on telehealth. Thank you.
Yeah. So I have a primary care physician asking if there is anything he can bill, as he was the admitting physician for a patient into the hospital who is now in the ICU, positive COVID, and the hospital restricts only one provider to see the patient a day, which in turn becomes the ICU provider, the interventionist. However, the primary care physician, the admitting provider, is taking lead in coordinating care with the interventionist and also monitoring the medical records of the patient daily and also speaking with the family. Is there any reportable billing for the PCP as the admitting physician?
So I think we'd need to know a lot more about the specifics before giving specific coding advice, but I would suggest that there are several non-face-to-face codes that might be applicable to that kind of situation, including there's CPD codes for interprofessional consultations that describe the time of both the primary care and the specialist physician in terms of interacting for care management purposes. And there's also several care management codes for monthly services provided to a patient, some of which could be reported potentially in that scenario. And those would be you'd need to look at the specific circumstances and the way the codes are described to know for sure.
Okay, perfect. Thank you very much for all your help and your answers. They were very informative, and I appreciate it.
Thank you much.
Thank you. We'll take our next question, please.
Please state your name and then ask your question. Your line is now open.
Hello?
Hi there, we can hear you.
You can hear me?
We can, yes. What is your question, please?
Okay, thank you. Yes, my question has to do with accelerated payments. We have gotten a quote from our MAC of what our maximum is that we do not think is right. And I know this has happened to other hospitals, or maximum hasn't been what they expected. Is there any specific remedy for this, or ways we can find out how the calculation was made?
Sherry, would you like to address this question?
Sure. Hi, this is Sherry McQueen in the Office of Financial Management. I can ask that you send your particular facility's information to the mailbox, and I'll make sure that I'll look into your particular concern directly.
Okay.
But to answer your second question in terms of the calculation, so for Part A and Part B providers other than those covered by the CARES Act, what the agency has done to streamline the advanced and accelerated payment process is to take a look back at claims history for a provider or supplier when determining the payment and looking at history that preceded the coronavirus public health emergency. So what we have done for, so we're going back for the providers that are covered by the CARES Act that received the 6 months, that could receive 6 months worth of payments. We're looking at claims history from July 1st of 2019 through December 31st of 2019. And all
And that's why we're confused. When we look at our we are a PIP hospital, and when we look at our PS&R, and we look at our PIP payments, what they're telling us doesn't make sense.
Okay. So then if you could send the information to the mailbox, and I will look into exactly what the concern is for your particular facility. Okay?
Thank you so much. Can you tell me what the mailbox address is or where to find it?
I'm sorry.
I can deliver that, sure. It is COVID-19 at cms.hhs.gov, and I'll repeat this at the end of the call as well, but in case we lose folks, it is COVID-19 at cms.hhs.gov. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We'll take our next question.
Your next question, please state your name and then ask your question. Your line is now open.
Hi there. What is your question?
Hello?
Hi there. We can hear you. What is your question, please?
Hello, my name is Melinda Renshaw, and I'm calling from Missouri Long-Term Care, and I was wanting to know your documentation requirements to utilize the 1135 waiver.
Hi, this is Evan Shulman from the Visit Restrooms. Can you be a little bit more specific to utilize the 1135 waiver for what purpose?
Well, for to waive the 3-midnight stay before a patient or resident can come in on skilled Medicare, what documentation are you going to require be in place to utilize that?
Okay. Can someone from the Center for Medicare answer that one?
Yes, this is Jason Bennett. This is a blanket waiver, so the waiver is available in all cases when a discharge may be under 3 days. What we recommend is that you always have documentation as to when you exercise these waivers. We're not specific about necessarily what that is, what degree of documentation that is, and we provide you some flexibility there, but I do recommend that you note that. And it could be because the patient is COVID positive. It could be because the patient may be suspected of being COVID positive. It may also be just because the hospital is concerned about its own operations and needing to make sure that beds are available for patients who may be presenting as COVID positive and are working to free up their bed capacity as quickly as possible.
Okay, so just some documentation, maybe from the discharging hospital or the accepting physician.
Anything like that would be satisfactory. That would be good.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We'll take our next question, please.
Next question. Please state your name and then ask your question. Your line is now open.
Hello.
Hi there. We can hear you. What is your question, please?
Hi, this is Christy. I am calling regarding documentation requirements on the new guidelines that were put out on the 30th or 31st regarding documenting telehealth and actually documenting telehealth via the time guidelines that are given for the 2021 E&M and advise if you require that something be put in the documentation as far as 15 minutes was face-to-face time, this was preparation time, and this was end time, or are you looking for anything that specific?
I think I don't think we can give particular answers about the level of specificity, but I think we would expect the same level of documentation that would ordinarily be required for coding those services based on time. So that can happen now for counseling, and so it would be generally similar, I would think.
Okay. Also, I've been looking for guidelines on BPCIA. Our practice participates in those. In the proposed federal rule, I was able to locate documentation on CJR, but did not see anything on the BPCIA program. Has there been anything published that will guide us in as far as that goes, participation in the bundled plans?
Do any of our CMS? Go ahead, Demetrius.
I don't know that we've got the right folks on the line to answer that one.
Alina, this is Beth. I can actually help you with that. CMMI is currently evaluating flexibilities for all of our models, including BPCI Advanced, and we will be providing information as soon as it is available.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for your question. We'll take our next question, please.
Next question. Please state your name and then ask your question. Your line is now open.
Hello.
Hi there. We can hear you. What is your question?
Hi. I have two questions. My name is Arlene. Thanks for taking my call. The first one is regarding the relaxation of the documentation requirements. And I wanted just to make sure, is it specific only to the office outpatient CPT codes established, the 99211 through the 215, and the new patient 99201 through the 99205 codes? So I wanted to see if it was, you know, just specific to those, and would that apply to Medicaid and the Medicaid products and commercial payers? Would they need to follow those as well?
So I can answer for the, in terms of Medicare, that change is related to the change that is slated to go in effect for January 2021. And so that's for the office outpatient visit codes, the 99201 through 15, as you mentioned. And it is specific to those codes. The, in terms of other payers, including Medicaid programs, I think they would have to make their own determinations. And I'm not, I don't think we're in a position to know whether or not they've made similar, adjustments.
Okay. Can I just ask one more question, if you don't mind? I did see also that annual wellness visits are on that list for eligible telehealth services. And I'm just wondering how our providers are supposed to obtain those required exam elements, such as weight and blood pressure. Maybe the patient can self-report those, but maybe they can't. So I'm just wondering, you know, would this requirement be waived or how CMS would be looking at this?
So I don't think the requirements for any particular service, including the annual wellness visit, have changed. I don't know that the requirements couldn't be met by a patient capable of taking some of their own vitals, for example. But I think it's probably also worth pointing out that telehealth isn't limited to when the patient is at home. While that certainly may be the most relevant given the current context, the rules are designed in such a way to also allow for telehealth when it's from one healthcare setting to another, including a circumstance where the physician or other practitioner might be in the home setting, but the patient might be in a healthcare setting. And so for some services, it's probably more likely that they would be more reportable or more likely to be able to be done when the patient's in a healthcare setting. But that is a question that we've gotten, and it's something that we're looking at as well.
Okay, thank you so much.
Next question, please state your name and then ask your question. Your line is now open.
Hello?
Hi there, we can hear you.
Hi, this is Cherie McNett with the American Academy of Ophthalmology. I have two questions related to the advanced or accelerated payments, if I could.
Please.
Okay, so the first question deals with the flexibilities around the time period for when the recoupment will begin. I know that in all of the information it has said 210 days would be the amount of time before the recoupments would begin from the initial payment. But there was an article today in Politico that stated that hospitals were going to be allowed 1 year to repay. Is that same consideration being given for physicians?
Hi, this is Sherry McQueen again. So to clarify, 210 days is the maximum amount of time that's given to the provider to repay the advance or accelerated payments for certain hospitals. So what happens is at 120 days, Medicare will not be making any type of recruitment between the day that the provider receives their payment to day 120. At day 121, Medicare will begin recouping from any claims payments that are made up through 90 days from that date. And if there is a balance that's remaining at that point, then the provider or supplier will be able to make a direct payment to cover that amount. There were certain hospitals that were part of the CARES Act that have a different time frame for repayment. Those hospitals will receive up to 365 days to repay their advance or accelerated payment. But the recoupment would begin, as with the others, at day 121. But the provider would have up until the 365th day to repay the full amount.
Okay, great. Thanks. I think the concern is, though, that if practices don't get up and running, this is for physician practices, until like June or July, but they've already received an accelerated payment, that's going to be very difficult for them to repay in that 90-day time period. And then on the second question, on the remittance advice for when those payments are being recouped, can you tell us what the code is going to be so that our doctors can recognize when those payments are coming out for their accounting purposes?
So I don't know the specific code. I know that there will be a statement on there, is my understanding, that indicates that COVID-19 as the reason for the recoupment that's occurring. But I can find out what specific code it'll be, and I can share that.
Great. And how would I get that from you?
So if you can send your question to the mailbox, I will send
Great.
A response to that.
Great. I'll do that. Thank you. Very much appreciate it. And again, echoing what everybody has said, we really appreciate everything that CMS has done.
Thank you.
Next question. Please state your name and then ask your question. Your line is now open.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can.
Great. Well,
My name is Kate Beller. I'm with the American Medical Rehabilitation Providers Association. I also want to thank you for holding this call and taking my question. I wanted to touch on an issue tied to patients over paperwork. In late March, I saw that CMS announced that it was waiving the requirement that IRF quality reporting program data from January 1 through June 30th, 2020, along with quality reporting program requirements in other PAC settings and provider settings. And CMS guidance indicated that this waiver included data that's normally submitted through the IRF patient assessment instrument or the IRF PI. I want to see if I could get some more specific information as to which specific sections of the IRF PI would not need to be submitted under this waiver, given that the IRF PI is also used for payment, as well as the fact that providers would normally face a penalty for failing to submit a completed IRF PI. Any additional guidance would be much appreciated. Thank you.
Alina, this is Michelle, and I can take that one on. We'll be addressing the IRF PI in upcoming rules, so stay tuned, and we will have more information on that shortly.
Okay. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Michelle. We'll take our next question, please.
Your next question, please state your name and then ask your question. Your line is now open.
Operator, can we take our next question, please? Thank you.
Your next question, please state your name and then ask your question. Your line is now open.
Good evening.
Hi, good evening. What is your question, please?
Hi, this is Jane Acevedo. I have a question regarding the physician supervision. Nicely, I had read in one of the most recent publications that in recognition of the fact that physicians are not in the office, especially during infusion like chemotherapy, et cetera, that the direct supervision requirement would be met if the physician was available via telehealth. What was not clear to me, even though there was a pretty good example there, but still didn't really answer the question, is does the physician to meet the direct supervision requirement so that he or she is immediately available should there be a need, do they need to be on a consistent open line via telehealth, or is it sufficient for if the physician might be available, you know, in an instant, right, that they know that they're supervising infusion, can you comment on which is acceptable?
Sure. So I think the use of virtual presence was intended to replace the in-person, the need for the in-person presence. And so to the extent that the in-person presence wasn't a personal supervision, so it wasn't necessarily in the room during the entire course of the service, but rather immediately available in person, the same thing would be true of the virtual presence.
Oh, wonderful. That's what I was hoping because I understood the intent, but it's very good to hear that. Thank you so very much.
Next question. Please state your name and then ask your question. Your line is now open.
We'll take our next question, please.
Next question. Please state your name and then ask your question. Your line is now open.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can. Thank you. What is your question?
Hey, this is Marie Alexander. I have a question about the hospital without walls.
Sure.
I'm wondering if you have more details on what conditions of participation are specifically being waived, and more specifically, I'm wondering whether the a patient's home would be an acceptable alternative.
So with regard to what COPs are being waived in particular, we have a list of the blanket waivers on our website. If you go to the both the current emergencies website or within that, a link to a coronavirus emergencies, the list is in both places. We just made sure of that this morning. It was just in case people were on one website or another. And with regards to the question of whether a patient can be at home for, I'm assuming you mean for an outpatient clinic visit. Is that the question?
No, I'm wondering under the expanded hospital without walls initiative, whether we can use that waiver to treat a patient that otherwise would have been in the hospital in their home, but bill it as a hospital DRG.
Hospital at home. Some of the others may want to chime in here, but I feel like that's something we're still we're looking at in terms of inpatient. I think we've gotten at least there was a request just saw today from a hospital system about that, and we're taking a look at it. I don't know, David or Mary, do you have other things to add to that?
Hey, Demetrius, this is David Wright. Yeah, no, I think this is something that we've had some inquiries about. We're actively looking into it, and we expect to issue some additional guidance shortly.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you. We'll take one final question, operator. Thank you.
Your last question. Please state your name and then ask your question. Your line is now open.
Hello.
Hi there. What is your question, please?
Hi, this is Karen with Bill Dunbar and Associates.
Hi, thanks for joining. What is your question?
I'm sorry, wasn't sure if you could hear me. I've seen information about the CR modifier for, I think it's disaster. I'm sorry, I had it pulled up here a second ago. For catastrophe disaster related service, and it's for items that are fall under the blanket waiver. I know that telehealth services are exempt from the use of that CR modifier, but what about, for example, the telephone calls? Is that part of the blanket waiver, and so is the CR modifier required on those?
Those changes are not part of the blanket waiver. So for the telephone call codes, they would not require that the use of that modifier.
Okay. All right, that's what I needed to know. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your question. And that concludes today's call. I'd like to take a moment and thank all of you for joining our call this afternoon, and more importantly, to thank you all for the work that you're doing in response to COVID-19. Before we conclude, I'd like to make sure that you all have the email address for the CMS COVID-19 box. And again, that is covid-19@cms.hhs.gov. Thanks again for joining our office hours. You can look forward to more of these sessions as we continue to answer and address your questions. We will have another office hours this Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern. Thanks again. Take care.